offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. Coming to you live from our studios at Prashant Nilayam, this is Prem. With me is Arvind. And we're here to continue with our satsang on the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, a compilation of beautiful interactions that Dr. Hislop has had with Swami in the presence of others. We are in the middle of a very, very profound discussion where Dr. Hislop is asking some important questions about knowledge, about the mind. And in fact, the last week around, we were discussing about a very important doubt that most spiritual aspirants must have. How much of what we learn, how much of what we gain in the process of spiritual seeking do we actually carry forward after after the soul passes through the process of death and rebirth? And that's the question he asks. And Swami gives a very, very beautiful analogy. We've heard it from Swami during his discourses too, where he says, when the butter is separated from the milk through the process of churning, there is no way it goes back into the milk and mixes again. And Swami says that that's how wisdom is. Once that is sought, there is no way it is going to mix again with the human experience. And that is, of course, is one of the most important points that Swami makes. And that is where we stopped. The conversation continues. It's not like that's the end of the chapter. So a lot of questions which Hislop asks this week, or rather the questions that we are going to discuss this week, are going to be a continuation of what Swami said then. But before we proceed to that, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem. What we discussed towards the end of last week's satsang about how what we do on the spiritual front, whatever we achieve, that is an achievement that stays on across lifetimes and births. It's possible that in this birth, I might not recognize some things that I have received as a result of my actions in the previous birth. But what Swami clearly assures is that once you attain the ultimate, which is whether you call it moksha, enlightenment, or brahmajnana, once you achieve it, there is no falling back. That's an assurance that Swami gives, and we have to take his word for it, because the only other option is to achieve it and then realize that it is true. So this is very important, because if there was a possibility that once you realize your oneness with God, reach that Advaita Darshanam Jnanam, after that, if you're again going to fall back into the process of, evolving and get into the samsara, then it seems meaningless in any way to put any kind of effort for anything. Because all said and done, even after reaching the final point, it's going to be back to zero and you're going to start again. It's a reset. Then it's no fun. I feel it is here that Swami's assurance that once you achieve the ultimate, there's no falling back and it's done, is a great motivator. Along with the fact that whatever we gain spiritually is something that will travel with us across births. And though there is no way to prove it, we can definitely appreciate it to an extent, because when we look around, when we interact with children, we see that some children seem to be more spiritually inclined, if I may use that term, or they seem to have more interest in sadhana and spiritual activities compared to other children. Of course, it might be because of the environment in which they are growing. But even when we look at, say, children who have joined first standard in the Sri Sathya Sai primary school, where the environment is the same, the food is the same, the interaction with the teachers, elders, and everyone is the same. With all of this being the same, still there are cases where you can point out to children who seem to be spiritually inclined versus those who are not. And possibly the only explanation you can give here is because of the sadhana or work done possibly in the previous births. So it is very reassuring, because whatever endeavors we take up in life, whatever activities we do in life, we wish to do something that is everlasting. So it might be as basal as our quest for pleasure, or our quest for money, or our quest for relationships, or our quest for power, authority. All the while when we are in the quest, we have this feeling that we should achieve it in a permanent manner. You know, taking money, I should make investment in such a manner that I need not bother about it throughout my life. It's done. My retirement is taken care of. My old age is taken care of. But when it comes to money, I have no guarantee that the money will be enough to take care of my next birth. It will take care of my post-retirement and old age. But what if I am born in some other family in my next birth? Will this wealth take care of me? I have no guarantee there. Over there, Swami is giving a guarantee that when it comes to spiritual growth, your spiritual progress, your sadhana, your efforts that you have put in this year, you don't have to fear, because across lifetimes it will stay. So when the entire mankind, when all of us are seeking something permanent as an achievement, even though we may not be sattvic in our nature, even when we are rajasic, when we are ambition driven, we are driven towards, we are passionately striving to achieve something, this seems like the only worthwhile achievement, because it holds on, it is permanent across lifetimes. So that is why on these two points, one is that the permanency of achievement, and the second point is also a permanency of achievement of sorts, because once we attain the ultimate, there is no returning back. These two are very, very strong motivational statements that we have got from the avatar of the age. I think we should put it in locker and cherish it and keep remembering it. That will help us keep focus on what should be our priorities in life.
In fact, Swami does say that this is what will lead one to a spiritual life. When you're talking about happiness, and we're talking about happiness that cannot be taken away. Swami would say that happiness is available in the world. I think even in the previous episode when we were discussing, Swami was saying that happiness comes from others, and pleasures give you joy, but bliss is different. So Swami would say that happiness is available in the world, but at some point, there is a frustration that this happiness can be taken away so easily. There's a success and you're happy, but the very next day, if something else happens, that happiness is completely lost. You can't even, I think we're not even in a frame of mind to think that, yesterday I was happy, or last year the same time I was happy. And that frustration that happiness is fleeting, Swami would say, that will lead you to seek for something which will not only give you sukha, but will give you nitya sukha, Swami will say. That happiness which is eternal. And when that is the case, it is understandable that even wisdom is going to be that which cannot be taken away. And Swami would beautifully say that, the three things, what comes but never leaves, what comes, and when it comes, it never leaves. What goes, when it goes, it never comes back. And what neither leaves or not comes. And Swami would say, what comes but never leaves is wisdom, and what leaves never to return is ignorance. And what neither comes or goes is the self. Right? So this is purely that kind of a knowledge, but the discussion that is going to continue now is going to show a little bit of misunderstanding that we have. Right? Swami would often say this, what you read, I could sit and read a text on the Upanishads, or I could sit and read some very, very profound works which are commentaries on some esoteric texts. But Swami would say much of what we read is bookish knowledge, and that goes with the mind. As Swami told in the last part that we went through, Swami said, you think you're the body and the mind. The body and the mind goes, but there is a subtler change which happens that will remain. So what we read, I think the duty is to ensure that it does not remain in the realm of bookish knowledge, but actually becomes a part of our understanding. And I think that is the difference. And there's going to be a short exchange where Swami points out that. But before that, I think Hislop asks another very important question about the mind itself.
Yes, he asks, and I quote, Swami, this car in which we are driving, I think this conversation must have happened when they are traveling by car from Puttaparthi to Anantapur. That becomes clear as the conversation goes on. And that's why Hislop is saying, Swami, this car in which we are driving has natural factors that are neither good or bad. If moving, it has speed and momentum. In like fashion, what are the natural powers of the mind? So Hislop says that by virtue of a car being a car, and a car being a car in motion, it has some properties which, they're neither good nor bad. It's not that you can, and it's not possible to give them up, because it comes along with the act of moving. So he says, just like speed and momentum. Speed and momentum are there when something is moving. So he says, like that only, are there natural powers or aspects of the mind which are natural to it, which are neither good nor bad.
I think it's a very beautifully worded question, you know, when he's talking about speed and momentum. Typically, a car, when it's involved in the accident, speed and momentum become evil. Somebody who's lost control of the car, or somebody's driving too fast. But the same speed and momentum is what is useful when, you know,
you're late for your flight.
Right, when you're catching up, when you have to get somewhere. So those are qualities of the car, and they're not good or bad. You cannot qualify them as being positive or negative. So he's asking similarly, what are the inherent qualities of the mind?
And Swami says, this is amazing. I mean, it's like a totally new kind of answer. Swami says, the mind does not have any powers. The only power is Atma Shakti, the power of the Atma. Actually, the mind does not exist. There is no mind. The moon is lit by the sun. What we see is the reflected light of the sun. What we take to be the mind is the reflected light of the Atma shining on the heart. Really, there is only the heart. The reflected light is taken to be the mind. But that is just a way of looking at it, a concept. There is only the sun and the moon. Meaning, the reflected light is not a third object. So, Swami continues, in another way, mind cannot be compared to a car. A car has a form. Mind has no form. For mind has no existence of its own. Mind can be said to be woven of desires. The Atma shines on the heart, whether the heart be pure or impure. If the heart is purified, and if the strongest desire is God, that is best. Beautiful answer, where Swami says that the Atma is like the sun, which shines on the heart, which is like the moon. And the moon rays that we see, actually are not moon rays, they are the sun rays itself. And Swami says the moon rays that you see is like the mind. So depending on whether the heart is pure or impure, you see the moon rays, you see the rays. And, you know, Swami has elaborated on this in different ways, in different discourses. One point that comes to my mind is where Swami would say that the Atma is the grandfather, the mind is the father, and if I'm not wrong, the speech is the child. So what you speak actually has its origin in the Atma. That's why Swami would say that have a control on the tongue is so powerful, it can change. The tongue is so powerful because it is backed by the mind, which is so powerful. You know, Swami would say that also. Mind is responsible for bondage as well as liberation. And the mind is so powerful because it derives its power from the Atma, which is the supremest power in the universe, which is the creator of the universe, which is the only, if I can say, thing that from which everything else has come.
Right, and it's a very, very profound analogy, I think, as when we were talking about the mind. There are probably many ways of looking at answering this question that he has asked. But as we have seen all through, Swami's answer also depends on the level of understanding of the person who's asking the question. And one of these stages, if we could put it as that way, or the levels in understanding, is to probably negate the mind or not give it that importance by saying that, you know, you're an entity, you have this power, you have this ability. So Swami is talking of that of, you know, you consider the mind only as something which reflects the light of the Atma and does not have any power of its own. In fact, the analogy of the sun and the moon, of course, is quintessentially Vedantic. Swami would often say, that is why it is called, you know, Chandrama Manaso Jayata.
Jataha.
The mind has come from the moon because of this quality, that the moon is not self-luminescent, but it actually reflects the light of the sun. But for the question that he has asked, you know, almost like asking as a sadhaka, what does the mind bring to the table? What powers does it have? And Swami is saying that don't look at the mind at all. Don't even consider it as being as important, because it only is a pointer to the real source, not by itself.
You know, when Swami says mind cannot be compared to the car, though Swami does not tell it, I just felt that possibly Swami is saying that what you call as speed or momentum, that is like the mind. The car has a form, whereas mind has no form, just like a consequence. And this is also in sync with what we had discussed when we did an elaborate satsang on the mind. We split the mind into four parts. The mind is manas, chitta, buddhi and ahankara. What is interesting is the manas, buddhi, chitta and ahankara are not actually objects or something that have a form. They are just different functions. Just like speed and momentum are properties of the car, in the same way, manas, buddhi, chitta, ahankara, manas stands for the sensing, the senses, buddhi for the discriminatory aspect, chitta for the memory aspect, and ahankara for the identification aspect. So they are just functions of the mind. So therefore, though we say the mind has four parts, they are not four parts, they are four functions. And it's almost like a software, that is not a hardware component. A brain has a form, the heart has the form, the body has the form, but the mind has no form. And Swami says, mind, what you see as the mind is nothing but multiple desires woven together. That is just like, again, this is another example Swami would give using his handkerchief. He would say, look at this handkerchief. The handkerchief is made up of threads. So also, the mind is like this handkerchief, which is made up of multiple threads called the desires. And if you become desireless, that is the primary or original state, there is nothing like the mind. Because again, Swami would say, if you start pulling out threads from this handkerchief one by one, once all the threads are pulled out, nothing exists. So, as you said, depending on our own level of understanding and our own spiritual evolution, different analogies strike our heart. And in the case for Hislop, Swami gives the analogy of the sun, moon and the reflected light.
But it is a explanation which is not easy to comprehend. I mean, if you're not well versed with the idea of what is the mind, what is, some you'd say, mind represents Maya. Because the next question which Hislop asks is that, when we are going through this discussion, or when Hislop is sitting there and listening to it, it is quite understandable that the process of understanding and comprehension itself happens through the mind. The mind is what is putting it in different places, right? When Swami is giving an answer, we are looking at the answer and say, this is what Swami's, explanation of what Swami had made a mention of in this particular discourse, and then it strikes you that, there was an analogy that we heard and this is what it stands for.
Very correct. Like the four aspects of the mind, I think all of them work there. The senses are there, the ear is listening, the memory is working, it's bringing back retrieving what we have connections, then there's the discrimination. All the functions, like you said, we are perceiving it or even understanding it through the mind.
Right, and that is what is propelling, I think, Hislop to ask the next question. He says, my mind and intelligence are in operation at this very moment, regardless of the subtlety or coarseness of quality. Baba says that the only power is the Atma power. So why do I not see as Atma that is in operation through the mind intelligence complex at this very moment? So he's saying that, I am understanding through this, and I think it's quite understandable that probably Hislop, who was 50 years younger, might not have been able to understand what Swami is saying. So which means the process of understanding has happened through the years, knowledge has been aggregated, understanding has developed. So all that is happening in the mind, and so the mind must have some quality of its own. Then how does Swami say there is no mind? And why is one seeing as the mind, if it is the Atma, the same Atma which is illumining all the mind, then why is one more intelligent than the other? Why is more spiritually, has a sharper spiritual acumen than the other? So all of this comes into place. So that is the question that he's asking next. Why am I not able to see the Atma in its real glory? Why am I still able to look at it only through the mind?
And Swami answers by saying, the Atma in its purity will be seen when the hindrances to clear vision are removed by spiritual practice, by sadhana. Real sadhana is not just sitting in meditation. Meditation is constant inner inquiry as to who am I? What is loving? What is harsh? Meditation is thinking on spiritual principles, searching out the application to oneself of what Baba says, and so on. And therein, the answer to why is it that I am not able to see the Atma whose power is shining through the mind, which I am currently using now. or even the question as to why is it that different people have different spiritual acumen when it is the same Atma shining through all minds? Why are there people with, in quotes, dirty minds, whereas there are some with pure minds? And Swami says that is the point. The point is, it depends on how pure it is. You know, the moon is able to reflect whatever it is reflecting because of its inherent purity or what it is. You know, just imagine if it was a black object. I mean, since it is a fairly lighter colored object, it is letting out light. If otherwise, possibly it wouldn't have been like that. So the reflected light definitely depends on the nature of the object which is reflecting. So it comes down to the purity of the heart. Because Swami says, Atma is the sun, the heart is the moon, and the reflected light from the moon is what we perceive as the mind. So, beautiful moonlight implies a pure heart. And so Swami says it all boils down to the heart being pure. And the process of purification or Chitta Shuddhi happens through sadhana.
It is almost like saying, you know, how when Swami says the interference has to be removed for you to be able to see in the Atma in its purest form, going back to the analogy of the sun being the Atma, trying to see the Atma through the mind is like saying that, why am I not able to see the sun through the moonlight, right? And so it is almost like, you know, Swami would give that very beautiful example. It is through the light of the sun that you see the light. You see the sun itself, right? It is not like any other object can be seen by flashing a light on it and you can say, okay, this is the object. But you cannot see the sun like that because sun is seen through the light that it itself sheds. And it's like, you know, you're having a filter in front of you and it is being illumined by the sunlight and you're trying to see the sunlight through this mirror or through this reflected surface. And Swami is saying that at that point when it is removed, that is when you can see it in the purest form. Till then you will see it like an object in the mirror. You know, it's like you have a mirror in front of you and you're seeing the whole world as a reflection on the mirror. That's what the Dakshinamurti Stotram says. The whole universe is seen like, as somebody put it, you're driving away from a city in a car and you see the lit city in the rear view mirror. So Dakshinamurti says that the entire universe is like you're seeing a reflection on the mirror. Okay, so it is like everything is what you see on the mirror, and you will never be able to see the Atma in its purest form as long as you see even the Atma as one of the objects in the mirror. The mirror has to be removed and you have to perceive it directly.
Like when you say that, how is it that though the moonlight, we all know it, that it's a reflection of the sunlight. And if I come out on a full moon night and say that I can see so much of sunlight, why am I not able to see the sun? I think the answer is very paradoxical, because if you are able to see the sun, guess what? You won't be able to see the moon at all. The moon will not exist.
Right.
So, I think possibly this is what is meant by going beyond the mind, because the mind is moonlight in this analogy. And as long as the mind exists, you're not able to see that. But the very fact that it exists gives the proof that God exists. The moment you're able to see God, you're not able to see the mind. You're gone beyond the mind, because then all your desires are annihilated. So, it's all, you know, because it's not explainable, it is something that should be experienced. I think Swami comes to that point later on. That is why we are using multiple analogies. You know, we are in this habit of extrapolating an analogy beyond what it is indicating, and then the analogy collapses. It is not to confuse us that Swami is giving multiple analogies. He is giving multiple analogies because the truth or the reality has facets or traits of all these analogies. It cannot be covered comprehensively with one analogy. If it could be, it would be done with one. That is why Swami gives multiple analogies. And when we take these multiple analogies, we definitely have to keep in mind that we have to stick the analogy to how much it is relevant, not extrapolate it beyond, because then the analogy collapses. So, we have to take in this analogy that the mind is nothing but the reflected light of the sun. It's not even the moon, it's the reflected light of the Atma. And the mind is constituted by desires just in a manner that threads constitute a cloth, which means that if we become desireless, there is no mind at all. And when there is no mind at all, that is like seeing the sun. When you're seeing the sun, you can't see the moon. It's all, you know, you have to use analogies together. And I feel possibly, you know, when we are trying to become desireless, to be desireless also is a desire. And like they would say, that is the last thread or the last straw or the final thread. Possibly that is the final thread. That final thread we are allowed to keep on so that we remove all the other threads. The one desire that I want to be desireless. And I think once that becomes the sole desire that is left, then automatically it just drops off and there's no mind.
And the other point that Swami makes here is about meditation itself. And, you know, he's saying that it is not about sitting quietly and doing some japa. He's saying meditation is inquiring as to who am I, what is loving and what is harsh. Meaning that looking deeply at, you know, whatever thoughts are coming, what is it to be good, what is it to be loving. Meditation is thinking on spiritual principles. So here, Swami is almost suggesting it's about what do you do with the mind. You know, it is like, are you able to constantly think about these higher principles? And the more you're able to do that, the more you'll be able to see or have the vision of the Atma and its purity. But for that explanation that Swami has given, Dr. Hislop asks another question. And of course, it comes with the years of sadhana that he has put in. Right? With that conviction, he says what he is saying here. He says, I have the conviction so strong that it is into the marrow of my bones that life is one and that other beings and myself are one. The Atma is that one and it is fully here at this moment. And I'm constantly engaged in that sadhana. So the question remains, why do I not actually experience that unity as no other than myself? So I think it comes with an enormous amount of conviction to be able to tell this to Swami, saying, you know, I don't know how many of us will be able to tell Swami this. Swami, I know for sure that everything is one and I've contemplated on it for many, many years. I mean, I have no doubt about it, but still, why am I not experiencing that oneness? So he's saying that if it is about meditation, if it is about contemplating constantly on these truths, I've done it. But still, you know, I have to remind myself that everything is one. It is not a spontaneous experience. Why is that so?
Whether we have done the sadhana or not, we can definitely appreciate the question. And we would love the answer because, like I said, we are always looking at the reward. And even when we spoke of Suprabhatam and other things, we spoke about the Phalashruti, where if there is an incentive of reward only, we are ready to take the step ahead. So even before we do intense sadhana, I would love to know that, you know, Swami, there is assured guaranteed success, right? Like Hislop is doing so much, still he's not achieving, then what is the use of me starting sadhana now? I want to know for sure that that is happening. So as I said, whether we have got the conviction by doing that regular sadhana or not, we would love to know the answer for this question as to why is it that a person like Hislop possibly, who has done so much sadhana and who is convinced that all are one definitely and it's only the Atma that is there, is not able to experience it on a moment by moment basis or day to day basis. Swami then, you know, put it so simply across. Swami says, your conviction of unity is an idea, a thought. It is not an experience. For instance, your wife has a chest pain. Do you have chest pain? If not, where is the unity? The unity of life must be experienced, not idea or thought without experience. And Hislop almost exclaims, he says, now, Swami has to say about experience. It's like Hislop said, I was saying about experience and now you are also saying the experience only. I am asking, why am I not able to experience? And Swami, you are telling that I am not able to experience because I am not experiencing it. If sadhana and conviction do not bring that unity as real experience, then how is one to get it? He asks. And Swami says, with steady sadhana, no special effort is needed to try and get the experience of that one. Just as with ourselves in this car. So they're traveling in the car towards Anandpur. Swami says, we need only concern ourselves with the careful driving of the car. And in due course, we will arrive at Anandpur. With correct and steady sadhana, in due course, the actual experience of one will naturally come about. Which means Swami is telling Hislop, great, don't get frustrated. Continue doing this. And just like as we continue to put the accelerator and carefully drive, when Anandpur arrives, it arrives like that. That experience will arrive, and then once you experience it, it's done. So just hold on, carry on. If it has not yet arrived, it means that you have not yet traveled that much. Continue traveling.
Ned, I think it's a very beautiful sequence of questions and answers here, because one thing he initially started off by seeing, Hislop started off by asking about, you know, the powers of the mind. Swami said there is no mind, it is only a reflected thing. And, you know, then he was asking about the intelligence of the mind, the ability of comprehension the mind has through which he is having this. And Swami is saying that all of that has only given you the idea which is in the mind. You know, the idea that I am one is there in the mind, but it is still not the mirror being removed completely. It is not direct perception of the Atma. You have, it is like, you know, there are many, many things that are reflecting off this mirror, but you have trained yourself to focus on the reflection of the Atma and say that, okay, everything is a reflection of the same source. That has become an idea in the mirror, but it is still not the removal of the mirror. But Swami says you don't have to worry about it because you're doing the right sadhana. Don't judge the final state based on the idea that you're having right now. Mm. Because that's what happens. Because that is where the question came from. Will I lose this idea? No, I'm in the conscious state, I'm having this idea. I'm not sure that tomorrow if I'm unconscious, if I'm, you know, going to Alzheimer's or something like that, will I still believe this? And Swami says, yeah, that idea will go because it's still in the mind. But the process is the same. You have to do the same thing as Swami would say, you know, Shravana, Manana, and the Dhyasana. The Mananam happens in the mind. What you listen to, what you read in a spiritual book, that contemplation happens in the mind. But it is that contemplation which will eventually lead to the mind getting sublimated completely and, you know, the vision coming. But it is a process in that sense.
If there is someone who has never tasted sugar and he is, imagine that person is educated and trained and he understands language, he knows the intricacy of language, he is very good at his understanding. And you bring him in contact with an excellent communicator who has tasted sugar. So here you have a person who has tasted sugar and is excellent in his communication skills. And you have a person who has not tasted sugar and who is excellent in his understanding skills. In spite of this scenario, how much ever they put in effort together, till the person actually picks a spoon of sugar and tastes it, he is not going to experience it. However well he might have understood, it might so happen that the person who is listening to the person communicating about sugar may actually go out and talk to a group of people and describe sugar in a manner which is better than the description of a person who has, description by a person who has actually tasted sugar. But still, the person who has tasted sugar is the one who has tasted sugar. And I'm reminded of that anecdote wherein in the 1930s, when Albert Einstein had become famous because of his theories and he was called everywhere to lecture on his relativity, special relativity, general relativity, he had a tiresome schedule, and those days you didn't have these Skype meetings and there was no virtual world at all. It was all the real world, and he had to actually travel place to place and give lectures, and he traveled to many places where people had not even seen his photograph. So the story goes that once, you know, his chauffeur, having attended all his talks, he knew his entire talk by heart. So much so that Albert Einstein tells him that in the next place, you know, I'll take some rest, you go and deliver the talk. And the chauffeur delivers the talk on the theory of relativity, special and general. And the story goes that when the talk is completed, somebody gets up and asks a doubt. And the chauffeur on stage with his presence of mind says, "Oh, you didn't understand that little point. That even my chauffeur will be able to tell you." And he steps down and Albert Einstein comes on stage to answer. Now, I don't know if this is an actual happening or if this is a very interesting story that has been cooked up. But the message is very clear that how many of our lectures you may attend and know it theoretically well, until you experience and know it, you will not be able to answer it. So much so that even if Albert Einstein himself explains it to you, it will not be possible. So in the same way, I brought up this analogy of a person who has tasted sugar and is the best communicator, because I think that's a good way to describe Swami. Swami knows what the sugar is, and Swami has got the best communication abilities. And a person who has got very good understanding but has not tasted sugar, that is what hislop is. How much ever the person communicating loves this person, how much ever he tries his best, he may actually give him an idea which this person can propagate to the entire world. That's what happens. You know, many of us also possibly to a certain extent take Swami's idea and we are able to share the idea in such a manner that it ignites minds and inspires hearts. But we also have the same thing that Swami, just like Hislop is saying, I am not experiencing it spontaneously every moment of my life. Because for that experience has to come. So the question comes as to when will it come? And Swami says, don't worry. Continue what you are doing. Have patience. Do it calmly. Continue it consistently. And when it has to come, it will come. And when it comes, it will never go.
And you know, that doesn't remove the importance of this contemplation, because Swami himself said in the previous one, you know, you have to contemplate on what Swami says, you have to contemplate on the oneness. If you look at it, I think there's a very important point Swami has said before, and even I think in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, the one thing is happening which is positive or negative, but the other thing is how the mind reacts to it. And the whole problem is there, you know, where you, when you talk about like and dislike, the way you react to a situation is what is the real problem than the situation itself. As Swami would say, you know, it becomes hot, it becomes cold. But when you say that I don't like it when it becomes hot, that's when the problem comes. And that's when your decisions start getting, getting complicated based on that. And there was a very beautiful analogy that someone had once said, I think when they were drawing the, border between Russia and Poland, I think, one of those bordering countries. So they were, you know, they were deciding which town would come to which part, which country and all of that. And there was this one farmer who had a huge farmland. So the choice was given to him whether he joins Russia or he joins the other country. And he chose to join the other country, right? So then the officers from Russia come to his doorstep and they ask him, you know, why did you choose to join the other country? Why didn't you want to come with us? So the man says, he's the man who is in his 80s. So he says, see, I always wanted to be a part of Mother Russia. But at this advanced age, I don't think I'll be able to stand another Russian winter.
Oh.
Right? It's nothing like a Russian winter or a Polish winter or whatever it is, because you know, he's after all going to be in the same place. But the idea that a Russian winter is more severe, you know, is what causes the thing. And as they say, a lot of our problems are because of that. It's not because someone died, or it's not because there's a, you know, I lost some money. It's because I think that that's a big deal that makes me suffer more. So when you constantly contemplate on these truths, right, it will make you see things as they are, first of all. You know, seeing the reality is the next step. But you'll be able to tolerate things as they are rather than building a, you know, romantic idea about it and then suffering more.
I cannot agree more with you. Just today morning I met a person who had come from the United States, and he was saying how he was shattered and, you know, demolished by Swami leaving physically in 2011. Apparently he's been coming to Swami from the 80s and he has had lot of wonderful darshans and interactions with Bhagwan. Last so many years he's been in the United States, because of which he would possibly have Swami's darshan once a year or something like that. What struck me was, he said that he really misses and it's so devastating, and for years together he was, you know, in a low, and now it is finally that he has somehow managed to come out and all that he was saying. I was just thinking that compared to what he was in the past few years, things have been the same. He used to come once a year to have Swami's darshan for 3-4 days or 5 days or a week. The rest of the 55 or 58 days, you would not be seeing Swami. Now also it's the same. But those 355 days, just feeling that Swami is there, you know, I can go and I can see, you would be happy. Now you are not happy. So like the Russian winter, I mean, it is knowing that, and you know, when not just Swami, any person, you know, when a person dies and he leaves and we mourn, if we actually look, other than those who are our close, maybe our siblings or our parents, others, it's not that we have seen them even in 1 year or 2 year. We might be seeing them once in 4-5 years. But somewhere we just feel, they're there, that's it. And I'm fine and I'm happy. The moment I feel that, oh, they're not there, then I start mourning. So it's got so much to do with the way we react to a situation. So a situation is not a problem. The way we respond or react to a situation becomes the problem. And, you know, just completing my line of thought on the question that Hislop had asked as to, basically it comes down to how do we know that we are progressing and we are achieving it. I think we had done an entire satsang on that theme. How do I know that I'm progressing spiritually? Oftentimes, you know, our spiritual journey, I just felt that this is an inspiration that I wanted to share, that our spiritual journey is often compared to a river. Because Swami says, finally, the river tries to merge in the ocean, but the ocean tries to push it back, and the river, there's a big clash and battle that happens. Means merger is not an easy thing. There's a huge battle that goes on. But finally, Swami says that the river bends low, the ocean comes above, it envelops the river, and then the merger happens. So, it is a struggle. Now, while Swami has described a lot about the final merger, just because Swami has compared our life to a river, I think if we look at a river, you know, we have got beautiful Himalayan rivers. Most of the rivers, almost all rivers, emerge high up in the hills as a spring. And in the initial phase, it is gushing, rushing down, galloping. There seems to be a lot of progress that is being made. I feel that's how it is in the spiritual journey as well. You know, the moment we just enter, you know, stop a few bad habits, start attending bhajans, doing namasmarana, doing a little seva, we see tremendous changes happening in our life. We feel, oh my God, this has changed my life. But having done the same thing after 10 years, we feel a kind of stagnation. And I'm sure that is the case with you, with me. I personally felt. Imagine in the college I used to feel, Swami, every day I come, I have darshan, I do bhajans and go, but what, Swami, nothing is happening. You know, that itself felt like, you know, having darshan and doing bhajans on a daily basis felt like stagnation. And I feel that is the nature of the spiritual journey. Because if we look at a river as well, once it comes flowing down from the mountains, goes into the plains, it starts meandering. It's so slow. And there come certain points in the journey of the river where you wonder whether it has forgotten its goal of reaching the ocean. But all that the river has to do is just flow on. It will merge with the ocean, and there will be a struggle, of course, but it is going to overcome the struggle and become one with the ocean.
Very true in a sense. You know, I think when we were talking about in some satsang, I don't know which one, we were speaking about sleep and dream and deep sleep. As they say, the most refreshing part of sleep is that deep sleep state, when you're able to really switch off completely, and that happens in a very, very few hours, you know, during the night. And that is what refreshes you. But the preparation for those few hours is so many hours. You know, you switch off the light, you ensure that everything is dark, everything is quiet around, you know, you have a comfortable bed. All of this is preparation for just those 2 hours. And same is the case, I think, with our spiritual journey too. You know, the real juicy parts of that spiritual journey might be few and far to come by. But it's required, you know. You have to go for 10 bhajans for one bhajan to, you know, have you melting and thinking constantly of Swami. You have to have years of meditation so that one day meditation will be so elevating that you will come back and, you know, something would have changed within. As Swami would say, I think in one of the discourses, Swami said, there is enough struggle in life, right? You know, we are after pleasures, we are after happiness. It's not that everybody gets pleasures and happiness easily. You know, we struggle. We, you know, especially in the world today, people do a lot of effort to earn their living. You know, they drive for 3 hours to work and they get stuck in the traffic. They put up with all kinds of nonsense the boss puts on them. All of this has gone through. Swami says, for a little bit of happiness and for a little bit of pleasure that you can buy into your life. Why is it that when it comes to spirituality, you start questioning how much more time? Why is it taking so long? Why am I losing interest? Swami says, it's because you do not value it so much. When you value it so much, you'll be ready to put up with all of the struggle. Just like how you value, you know, the very fact that you have to feed your children home rent is, you know, making you put up with all the other struggles that you undergo in your corporate life or your work life. Similarly, when you value the spiritual journey or the spiritual goal, Swami will say, you'll put up with all of this. And that is what is lacking, you know, that interest. And Swami was telling one devotee, I think, again, this is also mentioned before, where Swami says life is a dream. And he says when you're in a dream, you don't realize that it is a dream. It feels so real. And same is with this life. It is unreal, but when you're going through it, you feel like every problem is so real. So Swami says, just keep reminding yourself, this is also a dream. Right? And then Swami told that devotee, you might sometimes feel that you're just repeating it and you don't really experience it. Then Swami says, then you ask for me. Ask me for that experience I will give you.
Hmm.
Swami says, you don't ask me for the right things. You ask me only for worldly things, I give you that. If you really want that experience, as Hislop is asking here, how do I have that experience of oneness? Swami says, you ask me, I will give it to you. And, you know, what more can we ask from Swami? Then there cannot be an offer better than this.
It's not as if we don't ask Swami for things. On a daily basis we ask, but how many of us ask for this experience? If I just look back at the last 3 days itself, I know of 3-4 things that possibly I might have asked Swami. It might not be like a specific asking, but even just a wish. Oh Swami, I wish it is like this. That's also like an asking. But how many times in the last 3 days have I just felt, oh Swami, how I wish I can feel oneness with you? Maybe never. So, it is not like we are not asking God. We are asking for so many things. But how many of us are actually asking for this? And Swami is saying, you ask, I'll give. Because all the things we are asking and seeing that it is being granted to different measures, in different ways, to different people. But it is being granted. In fact, you know, remember the experience of one Vrindavan student. You know, this brother Muthu who plays the tabla so well. And he once, you know, wanted to get a good chance to, you know, though he was there as a student, we have all gone through this, we never get the chance to be in the front, get a close physical proximity with Swami, and therefore we resort to other means in our impatience, and he too did the same. He tried to bunk and scam the lines, go in the front, and the teacher in charge there caught him and put him back in the lines, and put him back not just into the lines, but ensured that he's the last in the lines. That made him feel so bad, and he was crying and feeling so sad. He tried even again later on, because if you remember, when we have to go for a tri session in Vrindavan, the lines start from the far end, the lines don't start from the end which is close to Swami's chair.
Right.
So there's a rush to actually sit far away from Swami. You know, that's also so philosophical and spiritual in its interpretation, that you are actually sitting far from God so that you can achieve proximity to God inside Tri Vrindavan. There also he tried, but he could not. And finally he ended up sitting somewhere back in Tri Vrindavan. And that day, Swami came, and as he stood at the jhula, looked and called this boy Muthu right in the front and said, you come front. And he was simply thrilled. There were tears of joy in his eyes, and he rushed and sat right at Swami's feet. And then Swami said, you know why I called you front? And he didn't say anything. And as if like proclaiming that lesson and message to everybody who were seated there, Swami said, this boy was crying for me. That's why I called him front. And then Swami said, you know, this is the more beautiful part. Swami said, when I go for darshan, everyone is crying. You know, practically this is not the truth. But Swami said, when I go for darshan, everybody is crying. And then Swami added, but I see those who are crying for me. You know, everyone is crying. But when Swami comes for darshan, he looks at those who are crying for him. Not crying for the world, not crying for riches, not crying for anything else. I mean, this is such a beautiful message, because it shows how do you ensure that God's eyes are on you. Like they say, Krupa Kataksha. Bhagwan's Krupa Kataksha is on me. His love-filled eyes are on me. The way to ensure that is to cry for him. But we cry for so many other things, rarely cry for him. We can rest assured that the moment we cry for him, his eyes are on us. Because that is what Swami himself has promised.
Right. And I think this part is filled with promises in that sense, where Swami is saying that once you attain it, it is not going to go. That's a guarantee which Swami is giving. Hmm. The other guarantee is about the sadhana itself. Don't forget about having an experience. Forget about, I think that's really a crippling aspect of many, many Sai devotees and spiritual aspirants. That desperateness to have something unique, right? An experience that we can talk about or write about or speak about, whatever it is. You know, we want to have an experience which stands out from our regular life. Mm. And in that desperation, I think we end up doing a lot of mistakes. Swami is saying that do what I'm telling you to do. Keep reading or keep listening or remain in satsang, as Swami, I think, tells even later in this discussion. And it will come. You know, you cannot sit in a car and be restless. The car is not going to move any faster. The road is not going to contract. You just have to keep doing what you're doing, and you will eventually reach the destination. I think we'll take a quick little break here, dear listeners. I think we have another half an hour to go before we conclude. So we'll take a small break. Don't go away, because the discussion is not yet complete here.
Sarve jana sukhino bhavantu, loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. Sarve jana sukhino bhavantu, loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. Sarve jana sukhino bhavantu, loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. Jagatiloni janulandaru aanandamunundali, ప్రగతి మార్గమున నడచి సర్వోన్నతి నొందాలి. జగతిలోని జనులందరూ ఆనందము నొందాలి, ప్రగతి మార్గమున నడచి సర్వోన్నతి నొందాలి. సర్వే జనా సుఖినో భవంతు, లోకా సమస్త సుఖినో భవంతు. సర్వే జనా సుఖినో భవంతు, లోకా సమస్త సుఖినో భవంతు. సర్వే జనా సుఖినో భవంతు, లోకా సమస్త సుఖినో భవంతు. పంచను చేరి మంచితనము నేర్చుకొని, మాయా మర్మముల వీడి వంచనముల విడనాడి. సాయి పంచను చేరి మంచితనము నేర్చుకొని, మాయా మర్మముల వీడి వంచనముల విడనాడి. సర్వం కల్విదం అంటూ సాయి సంఘులై ఎల్లరూ, కల్విదం అంటూ సాయి సంఘులై ఎల్లరూ. సద్గుణముల నందాలి, సద్గతులను పొందాలి. సద్గుణముల నందాలి, సద్గతులను పొందాలి. సర్వే జనా సుఖినో భవంతు, లోకా సమస్త సుఖినో భవంతు. సర్వే జనా సుఖినో భవంతు, లోకా సమస్త సుఖినో భవంతు. కోటికాధారం ప్రాణవాయువైనట్లు, ప్రాణవాయువుకు మూలం చైతన్యం అయినట్లు. జీవకోటికాధారం ప్రాణవాయువైనట్లు, ప్రాణవాయువుకు మూలం చైతన్యం అయినట్లు. ఉచ్ఛ్వాస నిశ్వాసముల చైతన్యం ఈతడే, శ్వాస నిశ్వాసముల చైతన్యం ఇతడేనని. విశ్వాసమంది సాయి చరణారవిందముల, విశ్వాసమంది సాయి చరణారవిందముల. జగతిలోని జనులందరూ ఆనందము నొందాలి, ప్రగతి మార్గమున నడచి సర్వోన్నతి నొందాలి. జగతిలోని జనులందరూ ఆనందము నొందాలి, ప్రగతి మార్గమున నడచి సర్వోన్నతి నొందాలి.
సర్వే జనా సుఖినో భవంతు, లోకా సమస్త సుఖినో భవంతు. సర్వే జనా సుఖినో భవంతు, లోకా సమస్తా
Welcome back, dear listeners. We will continue the conversation between Swami and Hislop in the car journey from Puttaparthi to Anantapur. Hislop says, Swami, is it not, I'm sorry, Swami, it is not possible to death, I'm so sorry. Hislop says, Swami, it is not possible to tell death to wait for a convenient time. In respect to death, in what state should the mind be? And Swami says, that we feel that only oneself will not die is the greatest wonder. Flowers bloom, give perfume before dropping. Whereas man, when his end is approaching, has only a long face. He should be like a flower and do something good and bright when dying. There are two things to remember, death and God. And there are two things to forget, any harm done to us by others and any good we might have done to others. Swami continues, for to hold on to these two would be to reach for future results, and there will be future consequences if these are held in the mind. Whatever we think or put in the mind, we experience the reaction. Of course, death should be held in the mind always, for then much good action will result and much harmful action will be avoided. So, when Hislop asks as to, you know, what should be the state of mind when death comes, because this is the state of mind we should always be in, because we can never say when death comes. Swami says that just like a flower that gives fragrance before fading away, human life should be like that. When the moment of fading away comes, people should remember the fragrance. It should not be that you should have a long face, which means Swami says that continuously keep doing good actions, keep doing good actions. And then Swami adds, it's not enough if you do good actions. Having done the good actions, forget the good that you have done to others. And not just forget the good that you have done to others, forget the bad that others have done to you as well. So if these are the two things to forget, Swami says, the two things you should remember is that death and God are certainties. You know, this is a very, very special message, because as 12th standard students, when we had gone to Vrindavan, Swami granted us an interview. And in the interview, the entire theme revolved around this. He told us there are two things you must remember and two things you must forget in life. And he started by telling what you should forget. He said, forget any harm done to you by others, because it will inculcate in you feelings of revenge. And feelings of revenge are not good for your spiritual progress. And then he said, forget the good that you have done to others, because when you remember the good that you have done to others, it will bring in you ego. Ego is not good for your spiritual progress. And he elaborated on that. And finally he said, if you have to remember, remember two things. The two certain things in life. One, death. Second, God. He said, he went on to elaborate on that, saying, death and God will help you set right your priorities in life. When you know that you're going to die, I mean, it is such a powerful thought. Many times I think that, you know, when usually somebody irritates you, you're upset with someone, you're having a fight, just think that tomorrow, if that person is going to die, or you're going to die, suddenly, you know, that doesn't seem to make meaning. That's why many times, if a person who passes away is a person with whom you have not had good relations with, and there might, and because of whatever, your ego, your anger or your hatred, you end feeling bad, thinking, oh God, why did I have to fight, you know. You want all the things to be cleared before a person dies. Forget other person dying. I definitely don't want to die wherein I am having a conflict with someone or a fight with someone. In that way, that is not the way I would like to go. So death in that sense is a very positive thing. It helps us orient ourselves. And if death is the kind of negative prioritizer, it helps us prioritize in a negative manner, God is the positive prioritizer. And therefore, these two things, these two prioritizers, we should never forget, God and death. And we should never forget that. And what we should not remember, what we should forget, is the harm that others have done to us and the good that we have done to others.
I think this is one of the statements which Swami has repeated so many times in his discourses. If I'm not wrong, one of the discourses in the 1960s, Swami speaks about this. Mm-hmm. The two things that you have to remember is death and God. It seems like a simple statement, you know, remember death and God. simple and also a little bit of intriguing in that sense.
Mm.
But you know, when you say you have to remember death and God, we are talking of two concepts that have to be kept in mind. When you say remember God, one is, of course, remembering God lovingly, namasmarana and all of that. But the other aspect of when you say remember God, it means, as Swami would say, God represents justice, right? God represents the perfection of the system where whatever you do comes back to you, the good that you do comes back to you, the bad that you do comes back to you. So when you say there is God, it is the belief that nobody can cheat me, nobody can come and, you know, rig the system, nobody can take away what is duly mine.
Mm.
If you really look at it, I think that's what we all lack. The person who starts becoming greedy and trying to grab, he does not believe that doing good is going to, you know, protect him. So when Swami says remember God, it means remember that, you know, there is one who is going to take care of the right thing coming to you at the right time. Remember that there's someone who is going to, you know, who is looking at what is the most beneficial thing for you.
Hmm.
And similarly, when you say remember death, it's remembering the nature of death. As Swami would say, what is it that you can carry beyond that point which we call death? Right? The moment you keep that in mind, the kind of things that you'll gather in life will be totally different.
Hmm.
Right? Why would you spend 24 hours of the day grabbing and gathering money when you constantly remember that you're not going to be able to carry it forward? Somebody was saying, I don't know exactly to whom it is, one of the devotees who had lost their father or mother in an interview. We all tend to do this, you know, when somebody very close to us, very dear to us dies.
Mm.
We wonder, you know, are they still thinking about us? You know, they're wondering if our business is doing well or children are doing well.
Mm.
So they asked Swami apparently that, you know, Swami, what is my father thinking about me, or is he still thinking about the family? And literally Swami laughed out.
Hmm.
He said, see, it is a soul which has been the father, mother of so many souls, right? Which means it has gone through so many lifetimes. And when you talk about a soul departing from this life or this family and looking about, you become like one of the many families that he has been a part of,
hmm.
right? And how do you think that he's going to be very fondly attracted only to you and your family and be thinking about it? I mean, when Swami says, remember death, that's what it is. That this existence is such a small aspect or portion of this eternal journey we're all in. Right? Automatically attachment will reduce. Automatically the greed will reduce. And when you think of God, automatically, as Swami said, you'll do what is right and you'll continue doing that. You'll not be worried about when will it happen? Will it come to me? You know, will I really carry forward this knowledge to the next birth? All of that is contained in what Swami says, remember death and remember God. So that's why it's a very, very important message that Swami has repeated over and over again over the decades.
Possibly we'll just go through one more question before concluding today, where Hislop continues and he asks, Swami, the mind is said to be dangerous. What does that mean? Because if mind itself doesn't have an existence and mind is nothing but reflected light, how can the mind be dangerous? Swami says, it is the same mind that can liberate or enslave. You know, mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha mokshayo, I think. And Swami says, the mind is like a snake with long poisonous fangs. When the poison is removed from these fangs, then the danger is removed. In like fashion, when desire disappears, the danger of the mind disappears. Hislop continues, but it is always said that all troubles arise from the mind. Swami corrects him, from desires. So then Hislop says, then one should control his thoughts. Swami says, thoughts and desires are not the same. This is such a beautiful point. Thoughts and desires are not the same. There are many thoughts that are not desires. If thoughts go too deep into objects, desires arise. If there is a desire, there was a thought. But not all thoughts are desires. Dark clouds bring rain. But there can be clouds without rain. God's grace is in drops like rain. They accumulate and then there is a torrent. If there is a very strong desire for God, even bad thoughts just pass through the mind and are not held on to. Desire directed to God brings discrimination. Intelligence which is discrimination is not the mind, nor is it thought. Intelligence is direct Atma Shakti, a direct force of the Atma.
I think this is one of the most important points which Lord Krishna makes in the Gita, and I think we've made a reference to that shloka many times, where Swami says all thoughts are not dangerous and all thoughts are not desires, but the desires are dangerous. Very, very beautifully Swami says, you know, when you dwell on some thoughts, it becomes desires. That's what Krishna says, right? Dhyayate vishayan pumsaha sangasteshu jayate, which means dhyayate, when you constantly contemplate on one particular thought. There are many thoughts which come and go. You know, you're walking down the market, you see a plush new car. For a moment you might think, oh, that's a nice car. That doesn't become a trouble. But then you say that, oh, that's a car, and you know, I will not be happy unless I own one. And that's where the problem starts. And that's why he says, you know, when with that contemplation comes attachment, and from the attachment comes desire. So Swami making that very clear distinction, and that is also a indication of how you can stop thoughts from becoming desires. That when you constantly have something running on your mind, before it becomes an attachment and a desire, you find ways of sublimating it, and that also Swami gives. That when you have desires for God, desire for God, that has the ability to overrule all other thoughts, which means thoughts will come and go, but you know, it will not become desires. That's why Swami would say that, you know, you want to please Swami, all other desires which might want to seek fulfillment will not find the fulfillment if you say that, no, this does not have the approval of Swami. Or, you know, I will not be able to accommodate this in my love for Swami. Automatically those desires fall away. So Swami is giving both the giving the mechanism of how thoughts turn into desires, but at the same time also saying how to handle those thoughts and not let them become desires. That's it.
In fact, in one of the interviews that my father got as a teenager, he told Swami, Swami, I get so many bad thoughts, what I should do? Swami said, see, when you stand and look at a river, there are so many things floating in the river. Don't hold on to it. Let it just flow with the river. It will go off and it will no longer be in your sight. And it's precisely the same message that Swami gave him there also, that bad thoughts are not bad desires unless you hold on to them and ruminate on them. Swami said that when you're standing and looking at a river, there'll be so many flotsam, you know, things floating on it. You see the thing and it's gone. It's over. Now the moment you see it and you get attracted to it and you start pursuing it, you are also running alongside the river, then I think it has become an obsession and you are wanting it. That is what is bad. But if it happens to float by, just allow it to float, it's gone. It's no longer there. That's how Swami, you know, that is what Swami advised my father when it came to bad thoughts. And I think that's what it is. When we get bad thoughts, just let them, it arose and it's gone. We can ensure that we don't put in effort in, you know, holding on to that thought and thinking about it. That's why, you know, when we get a good idea or when we get a good thought, people say, yeah, you hold on to that thought. Because you need to hold on to some good thing and let it grow into it. If you say that, hey, how I wish I am not crazy behind this world and let me just go to Swami. Yes, hold on to that thought. Now think of it 5 times, 10 times, because the moment you hold on to it, it starts developing into desire, and that desire becomes like desire for God. The beautiful thing is, what works negatively also works positively. The last couple of weeks, I've been working on, you know, a couple of our hosted videos for our YouTube channel, which are on habits and addictions. The thing is, there are some good habits and good addictions as well. You know, addiction for God, they are good. And the beautiful thing is, whether it's a bad habit or a good habit, the way it comes about is the same. Swami says it starts with the thought, and when you hold on to that thought repeatedly, it becomes an action. When you do an action repeatedly, it becomes a tendency. A tendency grows into a habit. A habit then grows into your character. So, the root is the same. What we can do intelligently is ensure that because we know the root, we don't hold on to bad thoughts. A bad thought came, okay, it's gone, forget about it. And at the same time, we hold on to good thoughts because we know that by holding on to good thoughts, it's going to develop into an attachment, into a tendency, into a habit, and also into our character. So, I think knowing that the root is the same, we can benefit by practically using it to give up the bad desires and inculcate good desires, godly desires.
I think that's precisely what we do. You know, we let all our good thoughts come and go and flow with the river. And as Swami would say, something which is negative, it's the feeling of guilt is so easy to come by, especially in the spiritual path. And that's what most of us would have gone through. And in front of Swami, when Swami asks, what happened? Anything? Do you have any doubt, Swami, what to do with bad thoughts? because we all tend to identify with something like that. And that was one thing which Swami would always break down. As one of the discourses, Swami said, you know, people say to err is human, right? Swami said, who gave you this idea?
It's not a license to make errors.
Swami would say, to be human is to be divine. So when you say to err is human, you are giving yourself license by labeling yourself, saying that, oh, it's okay. Being a human, you're able to. Maybe it's good to have it for others. Right? After all, he's human. That will give you a sense of, you know, forgiving nature and empathy. As Swami said, most of these are tools. Right? You're supposed to forget something, you're supposed to remember something. As someone once beautifully asked, he said, see, when you do something good for others, you're supposed to forget it, which means you're supposed to give up the idea of doership. But when someone else does something good for you, you're supposed to remember it, which means you're reiterating his doership. Right? But that's what it is. It's a tool. As Swami so clearly said, even in that class interview, he was saying, this helps you develop a good quality. That helps you give up a bad quality. So you just use the tool. So that is what we need to do and use it in that form. So as Swami is saying that if bad thoughts come and if we start relating to those bad thoughts, if we start labeling ourselves as a sinner or a bad person because I have those thoughts, eventually you will end up giving yourself that license, saying that, oh, I am this person. Swami says, no, don't associate with them. Let them, as he so beautifully said, let them just flow. Just see there and, you know, it's not the river. It's flowing with the river, but the crap which comes floating is not part of the river. You just let it go.
On that note, dear listeners, I think we will come to a close for this afternoon satsang. The next fortnight, we will be taking up a general theme, after which we will continue with this, because the next question that a visitor asks is that only, how is one to handle bad thoughts arising from envy, hatred and laziness? We'll not go into those answers now. We'll be going into it a fortnight from now. But as always, your thoughts, your experiences, your suggestions are all welcome. You can write to us at listener@radiosai.org. We offer this at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan with gratitude for this opportunity to think about him and think about his conversations. We will end with a bhajan, on the other side of which you'll be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.
Keep saying.